Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Jeffrey B. Simon is a Texas attorney and author. He is suing fossil fuel companies for $1.15 billion on behalf of Multnomah County, Oregon, which experienced a devastating heat event in late June of 2021. Mr. Simon is a graduate of the University of Texas Law School, past president of the Dallas Trial Lawyers Association, and is a fellow of the American Board of Trial Advocates. Mr. Simon, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you for having me.
If I could, Mr. Simon, I'd like to summarize what you're asserting in the Oregon climate case, and then we can begin our discussion. You're arguing, I perceive, that the heat event in Oregon was caused by carbon pollution from fossil fuels, and that the fossil fuel companies knew that their products were causing harm to the environment, and you believe that fossil fuel companies should pay for the damage that they have caused to the community. Do I have that accurately summarized?
Beautifully so, but I would add we also allege that they lied about what they knew, that they put out deliberate public misinformation for decades about whether or not the burning of fossil fuels resulting in superheat, extreme weather events, and further tried to reduce feelings of personal attachment to that. Gee, if it's happening, it's happening in a polar ice cap. It won't affect you where you live in America.
How did you reach your conclusions about climate change?
So in late June 2021, Multnomah County, Oregon, for several consecutive days and nights, a heat dome, sometimes called an extreme heat event, boiled the county. Over three consecutive days, the high temperatures in Portland were 108, 112, and 116. And in some of the more, you know, what we call heat islands or concrete areas, 124 degrees. And all of those temperatures are more than 40 degrees Fahrenheit above the normal high. And the community was simply not ready for it. Many people died. There was enormous damage to property and other infrastructure. And in the aftermath, totally unrelated to our filing of the case, some of the best climate scientists in the world studied this anomalous event, and they unanimously reached the conclusion that it was a result of carbon pollution from the burning of fossil fuels, which superheated the Earth's surface, dried out the soil, and helped a high-pressure system formulate and remain over the Pacific Northwest, literally turning it into a type of convection oven.
Mr. Simon, I'm wondering about the weather event, and I have read this, that it is likely, many scientists conclude, and maybe up to 150 times more likely to occur because of climate change. But the study also found that the heat dome would have been just about 2 degrees Celsius cooler without climate change. In other words, the high pressure system that you talked about still likely could have occurred. It would have been slow moving. It would have raised the temperature, but maybe not quite as much, but still in a very significant way. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I know exactly the paper you're referring to, as well as others which address the same question. And you're right that one study concluded that carbon pollution made the event 150 times more likely to occur. But it was noted that although it theoretically could have occurred anyway, it would not have been as intense. And I think we need to contextualize what we're talking about when we say 2 degrees Celsius. 2 degrees Celsius, of course, is almost 5 degrees Fahrenheit. And we're not talking about regional temperature in the broad sense. We're talking about the surface temperature of the Earth. If you think of your own temperature, which at normal is 98.6, what if the new normal was 101.6 and how you would feel with the lightheadedness associated with fever? And then what if you then actually caught a flu and instead of having 101.6 fever, you know, is now 104 or 105, dangerously high, could cause heat stroke and so forth. That is unfortunately what we have done with carbon pollution to the surface temperature of the Earth. We have a new normal where the planet is hotter now than it has been in the last 125,000 years. The last 40 years have seen the most steep increase in the surface temperature of the Earth in any 40 years that preceded it. And the nine hottest years in our history are 2015 through 2023. So what might feel like or sound like a small incremental change is actually quite dramatic in how it has affected the energy heat balance.
I mentioned in the summary that I talked about your suit that the fossil fuel companies have known, perhaps, all of the things that you are attributing to in your suit. How do you know that? What evidence do you have that fossil fuel companies have known what exactly they've been contributing to climate change?
There are several peer-reviewed published studies that address that question. There's papers by Professor Jeffrey Supran, S-U-P-R-A-N, at the University of Miami, and Naomi Oreskes, and a book called The Petroleum Papers by Jeff Dembicki, and other work that has been done where certain numbers of internal corporate documents have been unearthed with respect to some offices, as well as a trade organization to which many of them belong called the American Petroleum Institute. And what they reveal is that many of these companies understood as early as 1965 that unchecked carbon pollution would cause catastrophic, their word, changes in climate and make some of the world's most temperate climates uninhabitable for humans.
About 4 in 10 Americans in recent polling believe that climate change may not be a major threat to our country. And of course, as you know and our listeners know, it's become a politically divisive issue. What do you think about that?
I think it's terribly unfortunate, and it is a testament to the success and durability of what we contend is a deliberate misinformation campaign by members of Big Oil to try to sow doubt, to prevent consensus. You know, gravity is a scientific fact. So too is the fact that because of carbon pollution from the burning of fossil fuels, we now essentially have a shield in our atmosphere, which traps heat when it radiates back from the surface of the Earth and compresses it downward upon all of us. It's not a question of my politics, progressive or conservative. It's just basic science. But you're right. There are lots of things about which there is a broad consensus, but you will always find people who disagree with, including the propriety of COVID vaccines and so forth. And those doubters become sometimes the propagators, but sometimes the victims of corporate misinformation and exploitation.
What are the parallels, if there are any, and what should we think about relative to what happened against Big Tobacco? Big Tobacco, it was exposed, knew about the dangers that they were causing long before they were held accountable. Is it similar here in this case that you are trying to assert with your work against fossil fuel industry?
There certainly are meaningful parallels. I mean, they're both mass torts. That is, you know, broad-based series to have been committed by members of a particular industry. And the core allegation in both of those types of litigation are really two. One is public nuisance and the other is fraud. The public nuisance allegation is that the activities of that industry created an unreasonable interference with health and, you know, other public rights. You know, also that there was a deliberate deception, a misinformation effort, which the industry allegedly knew otherwise. Lastly, in tobacco, it was more typically governmental entities, states, for example, who brought those claims for recompense for all the money they spent on tobacco-related diseases, lung cancer, emphysema, chronic bronchitis, and so forth. Here it is similar. You have public entities bringing claims for all the resources that have been expended and are being destroyed by extreme weather that is the result of anthropogenic climate change.
Mr. Simon, I come from Wyoming, a big coal, natural gas, and oil-producing state. And over the last decade, I've watched, you know, many in the Wyoming legislature, the governor's office, et cetera, talk about how coal, especially, is in its twilight, that in fact, we will not be producing and consuming as much coal in the future, that we are bending away from fossil fuels, although the state is certainly trying to lengthen perhaps that time. But are we moving in the right direction, in a direction that is comfortable for you?
Well, I want to be clear that my work as a trial lawyer in representation of this community is not really a policy-driven objective. It is a classic mass tort. We're not trying to create new law here. We're simply trying to utilize long existing laws that we believe they've broken, that they created a public nuisance, that they committed fraud. And by that, I mean the civil justice system is an essential tool, a bedrock of American democracy enshrined in the Seventh Amendment, now 230 years old. But it's not a panacea for all social ills, nor can it, you know, make regulatory policy. So, you know, I come from Texas. Texas, too, is a big oil state, obviously. The truth of the matter is, A, we really are not reducing our carbon emissions to any great degree. B, the problem is already past a tipping point because carbon pollution remains in the atmosphere for hundreds of years unless we implemented technologies to literally pull carbon out of the atmosphere.
And there are efforts to try to, I guess, rationalize the technology to support that effort, but go ahead.
Yeah, and thirdly, you know, as I say, the purpose of the lawsuit is to force what we allege to be wrongdoers to pay for the harm they caused, not to force them to make different business decisions or different policy directives other than to tell the truth, to simply admit the simple scientific fact that A, carbon pollution is a substantial factor in causing these things, and B, they have not been candid with the public about that fact.
We're enjoying our conversation with Jeffrey B. Simon. He's a Texas attorney and author. And he has sued fossil fuel companies for more than $1.15 billion on behalf of Multnomah County, Oregon, which experienced a devastating heat event in late 2021. So why over $1 billion? What is that money for? And how did you arrive at that amount?
Well, they have at least $50 million in damage that was caused to what I'll call the public fisc, the taxpayer collected money in that county. It took many forms, you know, emergency health services, emergency medical services, and trying to provide emergency cooling centers and the destruction to property. The devastating impact it had, you know, over a period of time on the efforts of law enforcement and all the rest of it, because when you have that kind of extreme event, you also create chaos, and some of that chaos leads to criminality and so forth. So there's that. Even if the defendants, the companies that we allege caused this, provided the resources to make this community more heat resilient, remembering that, you know, this is a part of the world that is for many because of its temperate climate. It's not Phoenix, Arizona. It's not the Sahara. It was not built to be, you know, heat resistant. And in order to try to put in all the kinds of infrastructural and emergency systems that they need, because this type of heat event is going to reoccur. In fact, it has occurred again. They have lost more life since the event as a result of a couple of different extreme heat events. Even if that was properly resourced, it will take time to build. And so consequently, there will be significant damages even in the interim, even with the best of intentions, at least $1 billion. And then lastly, in order to build all the infrastructure, the reimagining of this community to be able to withstand 116 degrees Fahrenheit for sustained periods of time, that is an enormous enterprise that will take a lot of money, at least $50 billion.
Mr. Simon, I've wondered about local, county, state, and even federal government's laws relative to what you're doing here. And I ask that question with this thinking. Okay, these oil companies and these coal companies have been mining, and they have been pumping oil, and they have been regulated that whole time. In other words, what they've been doing, they have been operating under the auspices of whatever laws in the state or obviously our country. So aren't states also culpable here, and why aren't they included in this lawsuit?
Well, certainly that contention was made in the Held versus Montana case. The plaintiff in that case, a group of young people, alleged that the state's energy policy was unconstitutional because it failed to consider environmental impact. And the trial judge agreed.
Unconstitutional in the state of Montana because of how constitution was written. But continue on.
That's right. In the state of Oregon, we don't make that allegation. What's illegal, we allege, is to lie to the public about its environmental impact. And we allege that's what they did. It's no different, in a sense, than what you've seen in opioid litigation. It is true that prescription opioids are regulated by the Food and Drug Administration, but that regulation doesn't give license to any manufacturer to lie. So regulation is a meaningful point, but it is not an umbrella to engage in illegal conduct.
What sort of scientific experts do you plan to come and then testify on your behalf in this case? Give us, I guess, a playbook here of what you have perhaps decided on how to best pursue your case.
In general, there will be client scientists who testify this event was caused in significant part and made worse to significant degree as a result of carbon pollution, who the major carbon polluters are in the world in terms of the petroleum industry, and you know how much pollution for each of them is attributable under generally accepted science and what that impact is. You will also have scientists who will compare and contrast what these companies told the world about the environmental impact or lack of it from their fossil fuel activities versus what they knew was true. And you will have experts who will testify about what the cost, you know, economists, the costs in terms of the damages that were caused, the damages which are likely to occur with other heat events, as well as the cost of reimagining and rebuilding this community to be heat resilient and save lives.
Thinking forward here, I can see it playing out in this way, that there's a settlement, that there's no admission of guilt from any party. What should we expect coming up?
Well, as a trial lawyer, I prepare every case assuming that we will try it to verdict. So we never bet on a settlement, if you know what I mean. It is absolutely true that when a case settles, it is typical that the settling party does not stipulate to guilt or liability. That is common in litigation.
Wouldn't that be failure in the eyes of those who are watching here?
Well, we're talking about a hypothetical. In other words, I don't know that there'll be a settlement, and I don't know there would be a settlement where, you know, there was no stipulation of liability. But what I can say is that my client certainly has a point to prove, but more importantly, they have lives to save. And they need resources to do that. Build this community to achieve those goals. And so, you know, if down the line there were substantial settlements that allowed them to save lives, I don't think that would be a failure.
On to a different topic, Mr. Simon, and we appreciate your candor here. My wife and I just started to watch Painkiller last night. It's about the opioid crisis.
Right.
And the role of Big Pharma. What role did you have to play in that series, if any?
Well, if you mean in the litigation, I have been, you know, actively engaged in the litigation, was one of the first lawyers. I'm talking about my law firm at large, you know, with me heading this particular piece of litigation against Purdue Pharma and other companies in the opioid supply chain, and that I have been doing that work on a consistent basis now for 6 years. My law firm filed the very first claim on behalf of a governmental entity against, you know, opioid supply companies, including Purdue Pharma, in the state of Texas. We represent more counties in the state of Texas in opioid litigation than any other firm. And in our litigation here in Texas, I and my other colleagues who represent other communities in the state of Texas have worked together. We have a committee called the Plaintiff Steering Committee. I'm the chair of that committee. And we now have over $2.75 billion to be used throughout the state of Texas to provide harm reduction programs.
Are the results of your work becoming fulfilling in solving this crisis in your eyes, or is there still a lot more work to do? We all know just like we had talked about earlier, that Purdue Pharma did not admit negligence here, yet they settled. And here on we go, still having a significant opioid problem in the country.
I would say that the litigation has been extremely successful, for which I do feel validated, but no, we have not resolved the public health crisis posed by opioids. In fact, it has largely gotten worse in the last few years because as prescription opioid prescribing was ultimately brought down to a more legitimate and therapeutic level, you still had a generation of people who were addicted to prescription opioids that had been oversupplied to them. And unfortunately, when people are in opioid withdrawal symptoms, those symptoms are overwhelming. They simply cannot be tolerated. I'm talking about, you know, the vomiting, the incessant diarrhea, the seizures, the heaving withdrawals, the tachycardia, all of it. And when a person is in that state, they really only have two options. One is to immediately get into detox and receive addiction treatment, which many people don't have access to, although that's what we've been trying to do through our settlement monies, is to increase their access. Or the second is to get another opioid in their body. And unfortunately for many, turning to street opioids like heroin was how they managed their addiction. And then that heroin supply was increasingly tainted with illicit fentanyl. And so now, you know, ironically, the largest public health crisis in American history that's related to a drug was not started by shadowy foreign cartels. It was started by some of America's largest drug companies' strategies conceived in boardrooms. But now it has unfortunately evolved into a larger public health crisis that is being fueled by shadowy cartels who spike street drugs of virtually every description with illicit fentanyl. We now have more illicit fentanyl in America than would be needed to kill every single American.
We're looking forward to watching more of that Netflix series for sure. Lastly, we have about a minute, Mr. Simon. You've written a new book, Last Rights, The Fight to Save the Seventh Amendment. It's now out. Give me the summary.
Thank you for that. My book, Last Rights, exposes how large corporations and the politicians they pay are deliberately robbing you and every American consumer of their rights to hold bad companies that hurt or cheat them accountable, and how we must push back to restore our rights before we lose them forever. In settings like this one, we talk about cutting edge issues in litigation and engage in debates over what are the best uses of our civil justice system. But in boardrooms of some of America's largest corporations, wealthy power brokers plan for how they can most effectively dismantle or skew that system for their own gain. And my book is intended to call attention to that problem and provide responses to it that will make us more safe and more free.
Jeffrey B. Simon, a Texas attorney and author, he is suing fossil fuel companies for $1.15 billion on behalf of Multnomah County, Oregon, which experienced a devastating heat event in late June of 2021. Mr. Simon, thank you so much for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you, too.
Coming up next, yoga, but with goats. But first, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Dave Thompson. The Mandan City Commission has approved allowing cigar bars. The 2023 legislature passed a measure to create a cigar bar exemption from the state's clean air law. That law was passed by voters in 2012, or was an initiated measure, and does not allow smoking in public places. Mandan resident Greg Gallagher told the commission it had three options: let the state law take effect, pass a tightly controlled ordinance, or ban smoking altogether.
The state law, which was basically an initiative on the part of the state legislature, was a way of clawing back what happened in 2012 when the state electorate, through an initiative, voted in what became the state's Clean Air Act. That was a 67% vote.
Mandan Mayor Tim Helbling says he preferred the city have an ordinance itself to put controls on cigar bars.
We could table it, and somebody could open a cigar lounge tomorrow and there's nothing we could do about it. I would much rather we go forward with some restrictions personally and try to control it and try to make sure that if somebody's going to open one of these, it isn't as big of danger to those around them, the other citizens of Mandan.
The commission's vote was 3-2. Big Stick Cigars of Mandan asked the city in July to approve the addition of a cigar bar. It's been taken years of planning and several delays. And now?
It's great to see the power lines down and enjoy all the businesses that are adjacent to the to Roberts Alley.
Roberts Alley is in downtown Fargo. A project to upgrade the alley was a joint venture between the City of Fargo, XL Energy, and the Kilbourn Group to remove the unattractive hanging power lines and utility poles from the alley. The project took 7 years to complete. Mike Allmendinger is president of the Kilbourn Group.
Initially, it started out with the observation that we needed to do some improvements in the safety of the power lines that are running through the alley, and then also an opportunity to update the infrastructure that all the buildings have along Roberts Alley as well.
The improvements have cost over $1 million, and it gives the alley a new look.
We had to bury all the power lines. We had to find a new location for the transformers. And then the complex part is that we had to run secondary lines to all of the buildings as well.
Minnesota Governor Tim Walz says he's hoping further clarifications from Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison will be enough to settle confusion over the power of police officers in schools. Walz says he thinks some schools and law enforcement agencies do not understand that the change in state law does not prohibit school resource officers from physically restraining students when death or bodily harm is not imminent. But Walz says he's not closing the door yet on a special session to deal with that issue. For Prairie Public, I'm Dave Thompson.
On a day trip, you can see what's upriver from New Orleans.
The remnants of indigenous architecture, you see what's left of plantations, and you see what replaced them.
Get updated on the social and political scene in Germany.
We're not just gloomy Nazis, we're not concentration camps only.
And hear how people are getting back to traveling again. Join us for the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
Welcome back to Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Special contributor Brandy Malarkey explores the world of goat yoga, visiting with studio owner Julie Waldy in Lemoore, and learning more about raising goats from Lacey Inger of the Dakota Goat Company.
It's okay. My grandmother owned a yoga studio called Success Naturally Yoga and Image Center when I was 14 years old. So I grew up in a studio. I knew that this was what I was wanting to do, but I didn't know if I would be brave enough to open it in such a small town of 900 people in Lemoore, North Dakota, which is where we currently live. So I'm from Springfield, Missouri, huge town. I moved here from Fort Worth, Texas, even bigger town. And so moving here, I just didn't know if I would ever be brave enough to open it in such a small town and would it be fruitful enough. And anyway, I just said, you know, we're just going to do it. So I had a dream and I visualized a bit, like the white and the brown and the, I didn't know that it was this space. And then I had a dream that I needed to quit my full-time teaching job. I was teaching fifth grade at Litchfield Marion for the last couple of years, which is about 20 minutes down the road. And I loved it, loved the admin, loved the teachers, but I just had a vision that I needed to go back to my roots, which is what my grandma instilled in me, is helping people slow down and helping people connect their head to their heart and get rid of limiting beliefs and all the things. So we've kept it pretty chill. So I try to keep the cost very low because of the where we live. I just love it. It's a newfound passion. I was raised in a studio. I knew I would be in a studio. I just didn't know if I would have the guts to open it in Lemoore, North Dakota. And here we go. We've been very successful. And my favorite part so far about opening the studio is the community building that I'm trying to be a part of and trying to build. When I moved here, this area is a really hard market to break into. I am an extreme extrovert. It was hard because I'm transparent and not as many people were as transparent as I am, but you find your tribe. And just this week, I have 3 new yoga teachers going through certification. So I'm so excited to have other yoga teachers in this space. I have awesome dance teachers too. That was super fluid. So everything's been very fluid and very easy, which are signs to me that God and the universe and everyone is just on my side, you know, helping out. And this is the right thing to do at the right time, at the right place. And I feel like this area needs something like this because these kids with dance, like they just come out of the woodwork. There's nothing for these kids to do. We have a tiny strip mall here with a bank and a cute coffee shop and a little clothing store. So we're very grateful for that. But I'm just happy to bring community, bring new blood, bring new job opportunities, and bring new excitement to this area. So we just opened May 1st, 2023, and we've been booming ever since. So I'm hoping we just go up and to the right from here and just keep growing. And we serve a lot of people from Oaks. So Oaks population comes in, Edgeley population comes in. Lisbon actually has their own studio, which is about 45 minutes away. So I haven't had many Lisbon yet, but it would be nice to like maybe go there and meet some of their teachers and team teach and kind of get some fluidity going there. I would love to do that. And Litchfield is right next to Lemoore. So we've got some Litchfield folks coming in too. I live in Marion, North Dakota. 20 minutes from here, population 100. So talk about a culture shock when I lived here and moved here. So I've lived here for 5 years. And so any fun things we can do now that I feel rooted and I feel acclimated, we're trying to do. So if any listeners or if you guys have any ideas that you would like to see in here, or if anyone wants to come rent this space and do something fun with the kids, this is also rentable. We just do $50 for 2 hours, or you can rent the whole studio for $100 for the whole day.
So the question is, are people bringing their goats here to do yoga, or how does this
I
work?
I love that. So we do live in a farming community, but people are not bringing their pet goats. Although people, I think, do have pet goats here, which is why I had not done goat yoga here. But Lacey and Jess are co-owners of Dakota Goat Co., and they bring in their cutest little babies. Some of them are a little bit bigger, but the goats are therapeutic to watch. The goats are therapeutic to hear. The goats are therapeutic if you're in down dog or tabletop. We're training these goats to come to us, and we're training these goats to jump on our backs for a little bit of massage. They're super tiny. It feels good. It does not hurt.
So how do you train a goat to do yoga?
Yeah, we use cereal. We use like sugar cereal, and you give them treats when they
do. Is this sort of like the silly rabbit tricks are for kids?
Yes, very similar. Yeah, that's hilarious. At the beginning of class, we say who likes the goats or who wants the goats next to them. It's very funny. I know she wouldn't care, so I'll go ahead and say her name. Lily is a coach here. She's a volleyball coach here, and she comes every Wednesday night to yoga. She's one of our best students, and she does yoga mostly for the flexibility, but she's like, oh, I'm going to come try out this goat yoga. And she did not love the goats. And it was my favorite part, watching her faces as she's like in, you know, a tabletop position, or where the goat's like trying to chew on her toe. And it's hilarious. And I supply the mats because sometimes the goats do want to chew on your mat. And there are little accidents, and we just switch out your mats really fast without you even noticing.
All right, so sometimes they nibble on the mat, and you just said that sometimes they nibble on your toes. So do people have to worry about like what they wear and put their hair up?
Oh, that's a great idea. Yeah, we, like I said, we have all shapes and sizes. Most people come to the studio straight from work. So sometimes they'll wear their scrubs, sometimes they won't. I do not put my hair back. You can, my hair's about shoulder length.
Well, I don't see any goat shapes.
Yeah.
Chunks.
No, yeah. Nobody, if they're like super calm, they're super trained. Lacey and Jess, they have an awesome company, Dakota Goat Co., and they are with them, I would say, a lot of hours during the day. So these goats are like pets. They're very trained. They're very calm. So, and they're a little tiny. So it's not like a big goat.
So since they have a business selling goats, does that mean that if you fall in love with your yoga goat, you can put in an offer and take it home with you?
That is correct. You actually really can. All the goats out here are for sale. Yep. And so you literally can. But if you do fall in love with your goat, yes, you can take your goat home and have it as a pet.
So if you sneak it into your trunk and take off with it, it's both kidnapping and theft.
Well, I won't like spread any rumors, but around these parts, they just pick up an imaginary rug and sweep it under the table. So I think you'd be just fine. So some people say that goat yoga is really helping people in tangible ways. And a lot of people claim that it helps them overcome anxiety and depression.
Is that because the goats eat it?
Or? I'm telling you, laughter leads to listening and laughter leads to fun. And in this class, we laugh a lot. So if you come to goat yoga, you're laughing. Goats are used for animal-assisted therapy for some people that suffer from depression or disabilities. But also, they're funny. And so adding the goats to it is also really, really great for stress reduction. And yoga and spending time with the animals can help lower levels of stress, which also helps your hormonal cortisol in your tummy, anxiety relief. And yoga and animal therapy helps ease symptoms of just calmness, right?
And but you are not trying to be like a certified therapist.
No.
Not certified goat yoga. They have not gone through special training.
No.
This is more of a fun thing.
No. So actually, Karparin Vinyasa is a more popular termed goat yoga. And I have so many certifications.
Okay, I didn't even understand what that
meant. That's okay. So I have so many certifications that sometimes they get in the way. I am not specifically certified in... It's called Karparin Vinyasa. But you can get certified. So it was originated on a farm in Oregon. They found the comfort in spending time with the other goats after a period of depression. And then this, farm owner had just gotten through a divorce. And it also helped cure like an autoimmune disease. So they thought, what the heck? So this was founded in Oregon in 2016. They have an awesome page. It talks all about it if you want to go check that out. So I am ready to go outside and show you a little bit about some goat yoga.
All righty.
Oh, hey guys, welcome to goat yoga. We were just talking earlier about why goat yoga. So research shows that the goats are actually good for therapy. It lowers your anxiety. They can lower your depression. So picture a bucket with like a boiling point, right? So here's the boiling point. You could be here, but you might laugh at the goats or pet the goats, and it takes your boiling point down just a smidge, right? Feel free to pet the goats. If you really know you want a goat next to your mat, please raise your hand, and we put cereal on your mat, and they come just a little bit closer to you. If at any point there is an accident, we just switch your mat out really quickly. So that's why we do them on my mats. I'm sorry, Katie missed the memo.
Oh, actually,
so you got the memo.
I did.
Okay, we're good. We'll just chill. All right, so here's your new mat.
No worries.
So that happens. That happened last time too. So Lacey, since Jess is helping Katie disinfect a little bit, and then we're only gonna use my mats at yoga, for this goat yoga from now on. So Lacey, would you be willing to just share a little bit about the goats?
I've been doing goats for about 13 years, and Jess and I have been doing goats together 3 years. Our company is called Dakota Goat Company. Mainly we do meat goats. We sell meat goats locally, and people come to our farm and butcher them, and it's a very humane way to do it because then the animals don't have to get trucked all over the country. The processing facilities are all the way out on the East Coast. And so it puts the customer in touch with the animals right at the farm. I like to say the goats have a beautiful life and one bad day. A lot of these are bottle goats. So that means they, for one reason or another, their mother couldn't take care of them. And so then we bottle feed them. They love weeds. We get hired once in a while to clear weeds. Or trees or brush or things like that. I like to say that they're vegetarian dogs because they can do almost everything a dog can do. They can learn their names, they can go on a leash. Sometimes throughout the years we've had various house goats for brief periods of time. Ask my husband how he likes that. but they're, you can house train them quite a bit, more than you would think you can. They put themselves away at night like chickens do. So you don't even have to babysit them that much. And yep.
All right, let's ground ourselves and then we'll get started. And if you want a goat on your mat, raise your hand and they'll come put a Cheeto on it. And or if you know that you want some goat therapy, raise your hand for tonight and they'll just kind of pinpoint you out. And then they'll maybe place some babies on your back every once in a while. So feel free to stop in class tonight and take a picture.
After goat yoga, Brandy Malarkey chatted with Lacey Inger of the Dakota Goat Company to learn more about the business of raising goats.
You must have had some surprises out of the first session.
I knew that the goats were going to have goat accidents. That's kind of a normal thing. I didn't know how other people were going to take that. You know, I'm always in with animals, and I have a large farm with all kinds of different animals. Goats are dirty. Animals are dirty. I knew that going into it, but I didn't know how other people would react. And so that was kind of a surprise, seeing the look on their face when goats were doing natural goat things.
One of the reasons why you do not bring your own mat.
Yep. Yeah. Well, one of the surprises that I found was the other people were so excited about it. You know, people who weren't going to be in yoga would come. We had a couple visitors this time, but we had a lot of visitors the first time, and they just walk on the sidewalk and lean over and ask questions about the goats and bring kids. And we had a lot of people come that first time.
Goat yoga, didn't know what to expect, did not expect to see you handing out Cheetos. So I assume when you got into the goat business, that was not your vision.
Nope. It just kind of fell into our lap. On my 30th birthday, my husband had seen a advertisement at like the farm store, and somebody was selling goats. So he thought that would be a good birthday present. And so we went and we looked at goats, and the price for females was different than the price for males. And we're like, well, we want two females. We picked them out. That's how little we knew about goats, because they charged us for two females, which were a little more expensive, but they sent us home with one of each. And every goat farmer knows you're trying to get your little bucklings out of there. And that's how we didn't know it for probably 6 months. And
so you thought you had a female pair, and suddenly you had a whole herd.
And then I did. I had more goats. Nature happened. And
so you learned on the fly. Yeah. How did that go?
Oh, my gosh. We had the most fun ever with, you know, the baby goats. And just they were so wonderful. And I thought, we got to keep doing this. And then I thought, well, how am I going to keep doing this? You know, what am I going to do with all these extra goats?
Well, yeah, so, not everybody has suddenly an unexpected herd and decides, hey, let's keep getting more.
Yep. And then I was researching meat goats. I had tried raising cows, but they were just so big, kind of dangerous, and I was a little intimidated by them. So goats made a lot more sense, and I can do almost all my own veterinary work with goats, and they're something that I can handle more easily and just makes a lot of sense.
So you were telling me a little bit earlier that goat meat is actually in really high demand, but we don't provide much in the United States at all.
That is accurate. Most of the goat meat that the people consume in the United States comes from Australia and New Zealand. It's extremely healthy. It's good for you. And there is a high demand, especially in cuisines that are from other countries. A lot of people from around the world eat goat meat. Western cultures don't as often, but I've eaten goat meat and it's very good. It's excellent. And
goat meat tacos are the best tacos.
I have heard that. I haven't had goat tacos yet. I've had goat ribs and sausage and all this other stuff that's super good. I'm still learning how to cook it, but
you,
yeah.
You grow them, you kill them, but you don't know how to cook them yet.
I don't know how to do it.
So do you mostly sell your goats locally, or is it a little further afield?
Most of our customers come from Fargo. It just spread by word of mouth, and they tell their friends. And we have a lot of customers that come from Nigeria or Ghana, some people from Mexico. And it's one of the things that I really like about raising goats is that I get to meet people from all around the world. I was raised here, and I'm married to a farmer. I'm not going anywhere. And the world comes to me because of the goats. And I get to meet all these really amazing people that I wouldn't have gotten an opportunity to talk to and learn about their culture. That's fantastic to me.
So do they like share recipes or anything? Are they helping you learn to cook?
Yes, they're helping me. Sometimes they bring a meal, like a picnic style meal, and they come and they set it out, and they always bring extra so that I can try it. And that is so good.
Now, we just got done with goat yoga, and you promised us that the goats we were falling in love with would not end up on the meat table. So what is your ratio of meat goats versus what else do you use them for, just pets?
Well, we do sell quite a bit of pet goats throughout the year, but one of the markets that we're starting to branch into is weed control, and so people hire our goats to come and clear out areas that are very difficult to get to with machinery, or They are opposed to using an herbicide. And so we come and we bring electric netting and set it all up and bring 60 goats, 100 goats, however many goats are needed, and they just clear it just like that.
Now, is that something you're starting this year, or is it?
We've been doing it kind of informally for a few years, just for friends and relatives and stuff. But we did do it commercially this year, and we put up some flyers and things, and people would call us, and so we had a few jobs. And the Forestry Service had contacted us earlier in the year and talked about maybe coming out and doing something for the National Grasslands. So I don't know if that's going to work out or not yet, but it's fun to think about.
You started by accident, and now with two goats that you thought were both female, and now roughly how many goats do you have total?
We have about 130 breeding females, and then some bucks, some wethers, which are neutered males, and some younger animals, so probably about 200. Goats go into rut, is what it's called, and they do that in the fall. And, you know, you hear about goats are really, really smelly. That is accurate, but only during certain seasons, and that's when the bucks are in rut. And, oh, my goodness, you can smell a buck from all the way across town. They are very smelly. I tell my husband it's just that the smell of money.
Well, one of the things that you said is that a lot of your customers are local.
Yep.
So have there been other local impacts that you've seen as you've started this as a business?
So now I have a business partner, and she got her sister-in-law started. And then we have another family that's living in the area that got started with meat goats too. So we're seeing it kind of branch out. And anybody who has questions about like goat health and stuff, we get a lot of calls about that. In the area, we're one of the ones who've been doing it the longest. There are some really big herds in the state that I did not even know about till I got kind of started. There's a couple herds that are like 500 head and over, which I think is pretty big. Getting other women started with it has been something I'm really proud of, because economically, women are not able to break into agriculture very easily. There's just so much upfront costs that you need, you know, tractors and all that stuff. And large livestock like cows are so difficult to handle. You need so many people and so much muscle and so much equipment, and it's very dangerous. And with goats, you can do it. You can do it. And when we go to auction sales, we're competing with men. And I'm super proud of the fact that this is an industry that women can get into, and the market is strong, and we can be entrepreneurs in this area, and it's a good value. People are wanting this service, so I'm proud of that. When we go to these auction sales and we're competing with men, sometimes the auctioneer will bring out like a little itty bitty pet goat sort of thing. You know, different breeds of goats are sold for different purposes. Like there's milk goats and meat goats, and then there's a couple breeds that are more common for pets, and he'll have a pet goat, and he'll be like, hey, ladies, I have the right goat for you. And we'll just be like, no, thank you. And it'll be kind of confusing for him. Traditionally, there's like three or four older men that come to the sales, and that we see them at every sale, and they see us at every sale. They buy up all of the meat goats. They really jack up the price. And it's kind of fun because we know we can still make a profit. You know, I don't know how to say it. We're in the man's world now, you know?
I mean, how cute is this goat?
Hey, baby, it's okay.
That was special contributor Brandy Malarkey with Julie Waldie and Lacey Inger. Dakota Datebook is next.
Hey, learners, did you know Humanities North Dakota offers free public university classes? These 2 to 12 week online courses are taught by some of the nation's most engaging faculty. With a wide range of topics, small class size, engaging dialogue, and no grades or tests, public university makes learning low stress. Learn more about Humanities North Dakota programming at humanitiesnd.org.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 20th. Dwayne Larson was born at Regent, North Dakota in 1916 and graduated from Regent High School. In 1941, Larson joined the U.S. Army Air Corps and was initially assigned duty as a truck driver. After achieving high test scores, he moved into flight school, becoming a pilot with the rank of second lieutenant. During World War II, he was based in England,
flying the P-51 Mustang fighter as he escorted bombers over occupied Europe. He flew 68 combat missions. His nickname, Swede, also became the name of his plane and was painted on the side of his P-51. Larson returned home as a decorated veteran with 6 air medals and the Distinguished Flying Cross. One of his most memorable missions was guiding a damaged B-24 back to England, saving the crew. He mustered out of the service in late 1945, but remained in the Air Force Reserve. Between 1947 and 1950, Duane introduced aerial crop dusting in North Dakota and ran the airport in Mott. He also barnstormed, flying at county fairs and air shows, and treating the public to plane rides. In 1951, Larson joined the North Dakota Air National Guard and served with the 178th Fighter Interceptor Squadron, flying the P-51. While serving in the Air Guard, Duane flew many other aircraft, including bombers, transports, and trainers. The 178th transitioned into the jet age, and Duane started flying the F-96 Starfighter and then the F-89 Scorpion. Larson was the 178th Squadron Commander when, in 1963, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, the unit was temporarily activated. Because of Larson's fatherly instincts concerning his much younger pilots, they hung the nickname Pappy on him. The squadron called themselves the Happy Hooligans after a comic strip popular in the 20s and 30s. As squadron commander, Duane Larson and his squadron became Pappy and his Happy Hooligans. In the early 1960s, the squadron was looking for an official motto to set them apart from other units. Happy Hooligans was the obvious choice, and the name was painted on all the aircraft. Larson retired from the Air Guard in 1969 at the rank of Brigadier General. He passed away on this date in 2005. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Scott Nelson. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. Tomorrow, in an excerpt from the Conversations on Healthcare podcast, two leading experts in LGBTQ+ health issues discuss what the Human Rights Campaign calls a state of emergency. Sue Balcom has some tips for wrapping up your garden as we head into fall, and Tom Ezern will be here with another Plains Folk essay. This one will be titled Quite a Historical Character. That's coming up tomorrow, when we hope you'll join us again on Main Street.